Settle down now.
Who said that? Who was that? Who was that? Settle down now. Norman Wisdom. No. Norman Vaughan. Settle down. Captain Mannering. Settle down now.
Thanks, Tim.
So here... Okay. Thanks, Andy. Welcome to the Costa Brava International Convention. My name is Paul and I'm an alcoholic. First, I would like to ask you to please turn off any telephones or beepers and remind you that there is no smoking in inside meetings. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organisation or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses or opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help others to achieve sobriety. We are requested to read this following statement from the AA World Service office in New York. This is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. There may be some here who are not familiar with our tradition of personal anonymity. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, film and TV. Thus we respectfully ask that AA speakers and AA members are not be photographed, videotaped or identified by full name in published or broadcast reports of meetings. The assurance of anonymity is essential in our efforts to help others who may wish to share our recovery program. Our tradition of anonymity reminds us that in AA, principles come before personalities. Please join me in a moment of silence for the still suffering alcoholic and to remember why we're here. Thank you. And I'll ask Dale to read a portion of more about how it works.
I'm Dale, an alcoholic. Chapter 5, How It Works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault, they seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose, in a general way, what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. As some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures avail us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people, wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice his principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order, I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one amongst us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he was sought.
Thanks, Dan. And now it's my pleasure to introduce a speaker. The speaker and I go back a long way, all the way to last Tuesday when I picked her up at the airport of Barcelona. And I'd never met the speaker before, and she'd never met me, and you could tell when she, you know, I had the sign. I was standing there for hours with the sign. And when our eyes met, she, you know, there was that relief. She'd found me and I'd found her, and that's kind of how it is here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when we find each other, there's that huge sense of relief and comfort and solace when we find each other. Because we're alone, you know, I'm lost. I'm lost when I'm alone. But when we're together, you know, we're found. And that's fantastic. And we chatted away all the way up to here, and like we've known each other all our lives. And I suppose in a way we have. Because we are all, both of us, and all of us here, suffer from the disease of alcoholism. So it's my very great pleasure to introduce, from Los Angeles, California, Eileen W.
Good evening. My name is Eileen, and I am an alcoholic. I'm so happy to be here. I want to thank the committee, particularly Tim Jay, who's been so patient in communicating with me and helping me make all of my arrangements to get here. And I want to thank Paul for coming to fetch me at the airport. And I want to thank Dale and the Portsmouth gang for really befriending me and driving me around. And I really want to thank everybody I've ever met in my whole entire life, to tell you the truth, because everyone that I've ever met in my whole entire life has contributed to make me the person that I am today, good, bad, or indifferent. And if I don't say anything else tonight, I want to assure you that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what AA has done in my life. I love what it's done in the lives of the people that I know in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what it's done for my family. I love what it's done for my friends. I'm a really lucky woman. You know, I'm a really lucky woman. You know, I'm sober. My sobriety date, just so you know, Billy talked about having a sobriety date. I have a sobriety date. It's March 3rd, 1975, which means that in March of next year, I will be sober 30 years. I am currently sober 5 years longer than I was alive when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, which means I'm also 30 years older, which on some days is no picnic. Thank you. My home group is the Brentwood Workshop in Los Angeles, California. And my sponsor's name is Julie C., but she's really a McCarthy. And her grandfather trained every one of their dogs to run to the window and bark when he said the British are coming. So, however, despite the fact that my name is Eileen, I am not Irish. I'm a Jewish person from Boise, Idaho, which is kind of like being a Japanese person from Kazakhstan, you know. But my parents are from the Bronx in New York, which is a much more acceptable place for Jews to be from. My father was a Jewish Marine, which is also very odd, and he ended up in Boise, Idaho as a result of being in the Marine Corps. And he was a baseball announcer and disc jockey in Boise for 10 years. And when I was 4 years old, we moved to Southern California, where I've lived ever since. And my story basically is I was the star of my grammar school. I peaked at 11 and a half. And it was downhill from there. And I was really kind of a brilliant child. I was a child who excelled at pretty much everything except for physical education and interpersonal relationships. Other people baffled me completely. I didn't know how to get along with other people. I didn't know what to do with other people. A friend of mine used to describe her state as feeling like she had been jettisoned to Earth without the brochure, you know? It seemed like everybody else got the rule books, everybody else got the instructions, everybody else seemed to know what to do, and she just didn't understand. And, you know, and the great paradox of my life was that everybody told me how smart I was. So I came into Alcoholics Anonymous wondering why I didn't just understand everything. And it wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I found out that the really smart people asked questions. And that's how they understood things. The two hardest things that I had to learn how to say when I came to AA were, I don't know, and will you help me with this? Because I don't know how to do it. I don't have any trouble anymore saying I don't know. I really don't care. And I don't know why it was that I thought that it was so important for me to know everything. You know, I sort of thought that if I ever asked anybody something, then they would know that I didn't know. And I'm not sure why I thought it was important for me to know or for them to know that I knew everything. But it was very, I mean, you know, there was no movie I hadn't seen. There was no book I hadn't read. There was no record I hadn't listened to. I mean, I knew everything, which is not true. I just told you I did. And, you know, because I couldn't let you know that I didn't know. It's still really difficult for me to ask for help after all this time. And I'll talk about that a little later. Anyway, like I said, I was the star of my grammar school. I was a very odd child. You know, well, let me just say this. I didn't have any pets growing up, which, by the way, is not a sad story at all. I don't want any pets. They require care. You know, they're a lot of trouble. I don't want any plants. I mean, every once in a while, somebody will give me a plant as a present. And I'll just look at it really sadly and think, you're going to die. You're going to die because I'm not going to water you. And, you know, in several weeks, I'm just going to look at you as you're dead. And I'm going to think, I really should have watered you. And, you know, it's even more dire with pets, so I know that I'm not supposed to have any pets. But I, you know, I work for a man. I'm a personal assistant in the entertainment industry. That's what I do, which is, you know, it's a great job because I don't get to run my own life, but I sort of get to run his. You know, there's a lot of stuff I do behind the scenes. He has no idea what I'm doing, and I prefer it that way. But anyway, he has pets. Well, he has pet. Up until recently, he had pets. We had Roger the dog, who's a yellow Labrador retriever, and we had many cats, all of whom have sort of gone on now. We had Bub the cat up until about 3 months ago, but then we had to have him put down. He was very sick, and we didn't want to torture him any longer. And they returned him to us after cremation. There's like the Royal Pet Cemetery in Los Angeles, you know, and they'll cremate your cat, and I guess your dog also. And they sent him home in a little gold brocade box. So we now refer to him as Bub in a box. But anyway, and when Bub came home in the box, my boss was sitting there laughing and pointing at him, going, oh, Bub's in there. Anyhow, since I never had pets, I never really saw the difference between dogs and cats, but I've had the experience of seeing the difference between dogs and cats, and there is a point to this story, by the way. I'm not just rambling on until I can figure out what I'm talking about up here, but there is a huge difference between dogs and cats, at least this particular dog and the cats that we had. Roger's a yellow lab, and I don't know if you know anything about labs, but they're interested in two things only. They're interested in attention and treats. That's basically what they're interested in. And so, you know, if Roger could talk, I mean, I like to, you know, sort of give voice to Roger. And if Roger could talk, he'd probably talk kind of like this. How am I doing? How am I doing? Am I okay? Am I okay? How am I doing? Ooh, those treats up there. Those are really good. Could I have one of those? How am I doing? Am I okay? And you give him one of those treats, and he runs off and he eats it on the priceless oriental carpet, and he's back in about 5 seconds. It's like, how am I doing now? Am I still okay? Am I still okay? Can I have one of those treats? You know, whereas cats, you know, if you have cats, you know basically what cats are like. Cats are kind of like this. This is what cats are like, you know? I'm the cat. I hate the dog. I want out of here, you know? And so I came up with this analogy based on my observation of these pets. And my analogy is this. I'm basically a dog. I am a huge canine. Huge. I want a lot of attention and treats. But as my alcoholism progressed, actually as my life progressed, I desperately wanted to be a cat because cats don't care. The only problem is I'm not a cat. I'm a dog. So the best I was able to come up with is I became a dog in a small fur cat suit. And I walked around desperately caring what you thought about me, but I walked around like this and wondered why nobody liked me. Anyway, that's kind of the story of my life, and that's really pretty much what I brought to AA. And you add alcohol to that mix, and it's a lulu. Anyway, I started to drink when I was 11 and a half, 12 years old, something like that. And I don't know if you've gotten a good look at a 12-year-old lately. They're, you know, basically children, you know? And, but I was drinking. I mean, you know, when I mean, you know, everyone talks about, yes, we had alcohol prior to that. I'm Jewish. We use it in our, you know, in our holiday celebrations. But the first time that I set out to get drunk, I was about 12 years old, and I was babysitting, and a boy named John brought over a six-pack of beer, and we drank it. And that was the first time I got drunk. And I have to tell you, when you're 12, it's a little difficult to get a source. You know, you can't just really walk into a bar and say, give me a drink, particularly in the U.S. But I grew up during the 60s. And, you know, and I'm not here to apologize for using drugs. I used drugs, you know. And I know very few people born after 1948 who didn't use them. But basically, I'm an alcoholic. If you want to get a bead on me, I like to drink the kind of wine, not beautiful wine like I imagine you have here in Europe, although I never got to Europe until I've been sober many years. But I like to drink the kind of wine that we have in the U.S. that my friend Donald describes as coming in and hovering over a grape, but never quite coming in for a landing. You know, that kind of wine. We call it Red Mountain, Ripple, Thunderbird, Mad Dog 2020. You know, we like this kind of chemical wine. And I like to mix this with medication intended for sleep. Only, I don't want to sleep. I want to sit in the corner and drool, or I want to be operating a motor vehicle. I mean, that's basically what I want to do. I want to be moving, but not too fast, you know? And, I mean, I remember when I was new and people would get up here and they would say things like, I took a drink and I ended up in Bangkok. And I would think, gosh, wish I'd ended up anywhere. But when you drink and take a lot of downers, you just don't get that far. But anyway, I didn't want to be here. And I don't know what it was about living in reality that I found so untenable, that I found so painful. I come from a nice family. I don't come from an alcoholic home. My parents have been married this last July 60 years. They're a set. Their names are Harry and Harriet. They have to stay together. You know, they're just... you know, and there was no alcoholism in my immediate family. There's a lot of alcoholism in my extended family, but there was no alcoholism. And truly, you know, the great paradox of my life is that I was born with everything you were supposed to have in order to make it. I was born with looks and talent and brains and opportunity and a supportive family. But I've been to thousands and thousands and thousands of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And there's one thing that I know for sure about alcoholism. It is no respecter of persons. It doesn't care who you are. It doesn't care if you are young or old. It doesn't care about your ethnicity. It doesn't care about your family of origin. It doesn't care about your religious background or lack thereof. It doesn't care about your sexual preference. It doesn't care about your financial status. It doesn't care about anything, because alcoholism strikes everybody. I have been to meetings all over the United States. I have been meetings in several countries around the world. And what I know is that the one thing that we have in common is that we are the 10% of the population approximately for whom alcohol does something entirely different than it does for the other 90%. I have an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind and a spiritual malady, and that's the truth. And I am one of those people that the big book describes as, it says we are men and women who enjoy the effect produced by alcohol or like the effect. That's much too light for me. I love the effect produced by alcohol, you know, and I know that there are a lot of strict interpreters of the big book, and that's fine, you know, it's our basic text, and that's wonderful, and, you know, but the truth of the matter is I don't identify with everything in the big book, and I doubt if all of you identify with every single thing in the big book. The one thing that I really do not identify with is the first paragraph of chapter 3. Now, I'm not somebody who can quote chapter and verse, but I can quote this because it means something to me. I don't identify with that paragraph. It says, most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. To my knowledge, I never tried to prove that I could drink like other people. I didn't want to drink like other people. I wanted to drink the way I wanted to drink, and I wanted other people to leave me alone so that I could just drink in peace. And growing up in the 60s was the perfect generation for a person like me. I lived a very marginal existence. The big book was written by a group of people who had a very different lifestyle than I had in the 60s. These were mostly people who were trying to hold families together, you know, who were trying to live according to a proscribed set of rules, for lack of a better word. These were people who tried to hold off until 5 o'clock to have cocktails. Not me. I lived a very marginal life. I pretended to go to school. I pretended to go to college. I went to college. I went in 1968 as a budding freshman. I got kicked out 4 years later as a budding sophomore. Somehow during that period of time, I managed to accumulate 31 units. I don't know how. I have no idea. I would pretend to work. I would sort of have a job, you know, but my job was drinking. My job was drinking and using drugs. That was my job, and that's what I did. And everything in my life that got in the way of that had to go. Everything. I'm talking about jobs, I'm talking about school, I'm talking about family, I'm talking about relationships, I'm talking about self-respect, I'm talking about dignity. I am no stranger to what our book describes as pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, except I didn't know I was either pitiful or incomprehensible. It wasn't until after I got sober that I realized that the progression of my illness was that for me, as I went on, I'm one of those women they describe in the book who has gone beyond recognition in just a few short years. I only drank for 12 years, but that was all it took for me. My ass was kicked when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no getting around it. You know, and for me, the progression of my disease was that the unacceptable somehow along the line became the acceptable. The untenable became the tenable. The unthinkable became the thinkable, and it just became a way of life. It just became a way of life, and that was how it was, you know? And by the time I got to AA, I simply accepted that I was such a piece of crap that I deserved to have everything that happened to me happen. You know? The two overriding things that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with were utter and complete self-hatred and total and absolute disappointment with the way that my life had turned out, because it wasn't supposed to be that way. I'm a nice middle-class Jewish girl from a nice family, but I have alcoholism. And the moment I started to drink, my life took a vastly divergent path. You know, I think there are two kinds of people who come to this program. There are the ones whose lives are fairly well together, and as a result of their drinking, their lives begin to disintegrate. And then there's a group who could never get it together in the first place, and I'm one of those. My life started when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's really the truth. I mean, I came to AA with nothing, and it's a really good way to come to AA, because you never forget that everything that you have that's good or decent or worth having in your life came only, not as a result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but as a result of being sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA did not give me a better job. The reason why I have a better job today, the reason why I've been at the same job for 17 years, the reason why I have an employer who says to me, I'd like you to work for me for the rest of your life, is because when I took that job, I had learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, the words that I thought were really dirty. You know, when I got here, you know, words that people think of as obscene were not the words that I thought were dirty. I still don't think they are, you know. I like a good, well-placed, you know, swear word every once in a while, you know, and but I don't want Andy to have to bleep me here. He said he had to bleep me. But you know, the words that I thought were dirty were things like job, you know, responsibility, commitment, because I knew that I couldn't show up. I had great intentions and really lousy follow through, you know? Because when you're drinking, you can't predict your behavior. My mother would invite me to dinner and I would say, oh, I'll be there. And somebody would say, would you like to go to Mexico? And I'd get in the car. You know, because it seems like a good idea to me at the time. I have a lot of really good ideas when I'm drinking. You know, I don't show up. I take a lot of unscheduled naps. I really identified with Bob, the guy who spoke the first night, because I've been known to take a nap in my dinner. I've been known to take a nap on the sidewalk. I've been known to take a nap in the middle of a rock and roll concert. I mean, I've just been known to take a nap. I took a nap during a Jimi Hendrix concert. I can't tell you how much that pissed me off afterwards to find out that I had just napped all the way through. But, you know, you take enough of those Tylenols and you're going to take a big nap. And anyway, I you know, this is what I do. You know, I don't function. I either drink or I have a life. I either drink or I have a life. And I know that AA is filled with people who got here having accumulated the trappings of life. You know, wives and husbands and lovers and careers and college degrees and cars and boats and ducks and whatever it is, you know, that you get. And I hear it. I mean, Hector got here having accumulated anything, and I met everything, and I met Hector when he was new, and I know that Hector is alcoholic. I just don't know how he did it. You know, because I can't function. I don't function. I function at a very, very low level. I just do whatever I have to do to just get by. That's what I do. And I drink. And I take drugs. And I get by. And things happen to me. And I ignore them. Like I get gang raped. And I get up the next morning and I go to the beach. And I get pregnant on a one-night stand when I'm drunk. And I have a baby, and I give it away 3 days later, and I don't think about it again until after I get sober. But see, I got here thinking that nothing much had happened to me. Because when you come here, you know, you hear all these stories, you know, about people who've been here and they've had 87 drunk drivings, and they've been in 52 nut houses and 47 jails. And because we like to play, can you bottom this in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And, you know, that kind of stuff might give you a lot of prestige in AA, but, you know, you try it at the high school reunion and they back off, you know? They are really not interested in your resume. And, no. So I didn't think anything much had happened to me. And the other reason why is because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was in 1974, I came to my first meeting. And I was 23 years old. And there were not a lot of young people in AA in 1974. And there were not a lot of attractive young people like we see in the rooms now. And I was one of the more unattractive of the unattractive young people. I weighed about 230 pounds of very attractive red-faced bloat. Because wine will do that to you. Wine makes you really pretty if you drink a lot of it. And And I was wearing a $5.99 granny dress from one of our local discount emporia called Zodi's, and I was wearing a pair of beach flip-flops, and I had some very spotty hygiene, and I had a really bad haircut, which I believe I had performed on myself in a moment of inspiration, and I had a really rotten attitude, and I have to say I was not a vision for you, okay? I was just not. And but I have to tell you, I'm living proof that you can have a rotten attitude at the beginning and stay sober anyway, you know? And I have to say this. You know, if everybody was capable of coming to Alcoholics Anonymous with a good attitude, I mean, what are we doing here, you know? I mean, I don't know why anybody would come here with a good attitude. I mean, my life had been so crappy. And I really didn't see how Alcoholics Anonymous was going to change any of that. I couldn't see, you know, this far in front of my face. I had no idea. And when you're new, you have no idea what's going to happen to you. You know, I have people in my life that are close to me, you know, who really, really need this program, but they don't want it. My son is one of those people. They don't want it. You know, and I just think to myself, my God, if they could ever actually see what this thing is, how much they would love it. Because one of the things that I've also noticed, you know, in all the meetings that I've gone to in my time in AA, and I've been to lots and lots of meetings, is that Alcoholics Anonymous, oddly enough, this very old-fashioned, very sort of corny program, this very sweet and yet forceful program seems to work for anyone who wants it, from the youngest punk kids to the oldest, most conservative people. AA seems to suit the people who want it. I have a friend named Mary who says, Alcoholics Anonymous suits me. And that's how I feel about it. Alcoholics Anonymous suits me. You know, and I haven't really basically fundamentally changed that much about myself. I'm still an iconoclast. I'm still eccentric. But Alcoholics Anonymous has turned me into a fairly positive individual. I mean, by myself, I am a negative malcontent. You know, I am such a negative person. And yet Alcoholics Anonymous has turned me into a fairly positive individual. You know, I've had a spiritual awakening of the educational variety that they talk about in the back of the book in Appendix 3. All those two pages are talking about is a change of attitude. I've had a change of attitude. I tend to view the glass as half full instead of half empty. And even during the times when I view it as half empty, I can very quickly get to a place, either on my own or with the help of one of you, where I can once again view the glass as half full. And that really is the truth, but that took a long time. Anyway, I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the summer of 1974. Like I said, I was 23 years old. I had no idea that I was an alcoholic, but I knew that I drank too much. And they used to have these public service announcements on late-night television in Los Angeles. And it said, do you have a drinking problem? And then they had a phone number. And for some reason, one night, I called the phone number. And they said, Alcoholics Anonymous, can we help you? And I had never heard of AA. I had never heard of it. I had no idea. I didn't know what it was. But I said, I think I have a drinking problem. And they said, would you like us to send somebody around to talk to you, or would you like to go to a meeting? And I said, no, I will get there myself. And sometime in July or August of 1974, I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was in a basement in Hollywood, California. And for those of you who've never been there, Hollywood, California is not very glamorous. I always feel sorry for people when they go to Hollywood. It's so disappointing. But it was in a basement, and I went to meetings in basements in Hollywood for about 5 months. And I did not get sober. I didn't get a big book. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't get a commitment. I leaned against walls, and I glared at people with my arms folded, and I dared them to come near me, and most of them wouldn't. And there were a couple of really mean guys in Hollywood AA. They're both dead now. Their names were Irving Neamy and Lee Larson, and they saw right through me. And they were nice to me. And I was drinking. I was never obnoxious. I was never rowdy. I never disrupted, and they let me stay. And I want to say something else, too. I'm always surprised now Maybe it's because of treatment centers, but like, you know, somebody comes into a meeting drunk and there are people who like freak out, like, oh my God, there's a drunk in the meeting. Like, hello? You know, the book isn't called Mental Health Anonymous, it's called Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and we used to see convulsions, we used to see people flopping around like fish, you know. I learned very valuable things when I was new, like how to shove a wallet in somebody's mouth to keep them from biting their tongue when they were having a convulsion. It was much more exciting when I got sober, I have to say, it really was. And we were really sincere, by the way, when I got sober. All of our meetings in L.A. when I got sober were from 8:30 to 10 o'clock at night, and I went to 9 meetings a week, and you had to be sincere because they hadn't invented the VCR yet, and we missed 10 years of primetime television going to meetings. But it was a small sacrifice to make. Anyway, when the holidays rolled around in 1974, I thought, you know what, you're not sober anyway. What would be the point of sticking around this outfit for the holidays? I couldn't think of anything more depressing, And I had this vague plan to come back after the first of the year, but my anniversary is March 3rd, so it took a couple of months longer to get back than I thought it would. But anyway, I spent my last New Year's Eve weekend doing the following. I always had a therapist, for the most part. I always had a therapist. Now, I have no argument with therapy, and by the way, neither does the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as long as I remember that therapy is treatment for things other than my alcoholism, I'm okay. But therapy is not a treatment for alcoholism, at least in my experience. But back then, you know, therapy did me no good because, as Hector said the other night, you know, if you lie to the therapist or you don't trust them, you're not going to get any help, and I wasn't getting any help. And this particular therapist was like the looniest of the bunch. I'd had a whole series of them. But this guy was the looniest. His name was Sid, and he was blind. And we used to smoke dope and neck during my sessions. And I have to tell you, needless to say, I was getting a great deal of assistance from Sid. And anyway, Sid persuaded me to go away for the New Year's weekend, 74-75, to this place called the Benneville Pines. Now, the Benneville Pines is a church camp in the San Bernardino Mountains in California run by the Unitarians. Now, I don't know how much you Europeans are familiar with Unitarians, but they're not like Southern Baptists or Lutherans. They're a very loose bunch, okay? Very loose. And very loose. And I agreed to go on this expedition because Sid promised me that they would have a lot of liquor at the Benneville Pines, which was the only way. And I figured, you know, if it wasn't there, I could kill him because he was blind. He'd never see me coming. But anyhow, I felt immediately better when I got there. I felt profound relief because they were unloading gallon jugs of some unknown vintage out of the back of a station wagon. And anyway, I spent the entire weekend completely intoxicated, having a three-way with two sex therapists from Carpinteria, California, whose names were Bert and Sally. I don't know why I remembered their names, but I guess I thought I would look them up at a later date. But then I got sober, and I sort of forgot about it. But anyhow, about 2 months later, I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have been here ever since. And I have to say, I came back for two reasons that I can think of now, and really, these are reasons I can think of in retrospect. The first reason was, I was tired. I was exhausted. I was just about the most tired 24-year-old you've ever seen in your life. And the other reason why I came back is because I had gotten a perception, not consciously, but I'd gotten a perception of Alcoholics Anonymous that I hold to this day. I remember when I first came around Alcoholics Anonymous, looking at it and thinking, AA is good, it's decent, it's wholesome, it's I'm hip, you know? I was so cool when I got here, I was frozen. And I have spent the last 30 years literally thawing out. It's just not that much fun to be that cool. But AA was unhip. And people seemed to be nice to one another here. I didn't trust it. But people seem to be nice to one another here. And the one feeling that I really got is I really felt that if I could ever let down enough of my guard to tell you that I wanted what you had instead of the crap that I was coming from, that nobody would laugh at me. Because I thought that if I ever told anybody that I wanted anything decent in my life, because I had given up having anything decent in my life when I was about 14 years old. I remember thinking to myself, whatever it is that's good or decent or worth having in life, I'm never going to hang it up, and why don't I just put it all down? Why don't I just, you know, make fun of everybody who's doing the decent thing? Why don't I? Because I knew I was never going to have it. I remember the night of my senior prom. I don't know if you have a prom in Europe, but we have a prom. It's a big dance that you have when you graduate from high school. And, you know, I was a total freak by the time I graduated from high school. I almost didn't graduate from high school, by the way, because I was in so much trouble. You know, I'd leave at noon and go get loaded and just never come back, like for a whole semester. I was in a lot of trouble. I'd actually gotten kicked out, and then they'd let me back in. But I finally graduated from high school, and, you know, and nobody invited me to the prom because you don't invite girls like me to the prom. And I remember, you know, getting loaded the night of the prom and just making fun of everybody. But the truth be known, I wanted to be one of those girls and one of those long gals. And when I was about 5 years sober, because the people in Alcoholics Anonymous understand these things, because we speak what they call the language of the heart. I had a friend named Richard Arthur. He's dead now, too. He was my first friend of many, many, many friends to die of AIDS. And, but he was alive then, and he called me up one day, and it was my birthday, and he said, get over here. He said, I have your birthday present. And what he had bought me was one of those giant cymbidium orchid plants with about 10 blooms on it. And he said, darling, this is your corsage, because you never went to the prom. And I was able to appreciate it. I was already 5 years sober, but when I was new, I couldn't appreciate anything like that. Anyway, I was very fortunate. I went to a meeting on March 3rd of 1975, and on March 4th of 1975, I went to a meeting at an old clubhouse in the valley in North Hollywood, California. It doesn't exist anymore. It's called Radford. And the man who became my first sponsor, a man named Bob Earl, backed me up against the wall in that meeting, and he said he'd seen me the year before. And he said to me, look, punk. He said, you have a serious problem with alcohol and drugs, and you better damn well get sober or you're going to die. And then he backed it up by saying, and if you don't get sober, I'm going to break your jaw. Now, I don't know what you would have thought. I thought, he cares, you know. I'd heard you care. I thought, he cares, you know, and I couldn't understand why. And I remember I took his phone number and I started to call him, but about a month after I started to call him, I couldn't stand it anymore. And I called him up one day and I screamed at him on the phone. I mean, the people of Alcoholics Anonymous are so incredibly tolerant, really. And I screamed on the phone, why do you care about me? Why do you care about me? And he screamed back at me, because you're psycho. I thought he was going to say because I was cute or, you know, something. Because I was psycho. And I'll tell you how much self-esteem I had when I was new. One night we all went to a meeting. And Bobby went to the liquor store to get some cigarettes. And I was still smoking in those days. And I asked him if he would get me some cigarettes. And I tried to offer him the money. And he wouldn't take it. And he came back. And he brought me 2 packs of cigarettes. And I couldn't believe that anybody was that nice. Because where I was coming from when I got here, if you did something nice for somebody, because you wanted something. And if somebody did something nice for you, it's because they wanted something. And I began to understand that Bobby cared about me because 13 years earlier, people had cared about him. When he made it just as impossible for them to care about him as I was making it for people to care about me. You know, I heard a woman describe how I came into AA in perfect terms. She said, I came into AA like this. Help me stay as far away from me as possible, but please help me. I didn't want people to touch me. I didn't want people to hug me. I didn't want people to do that. And as a consequence, of course, my first job in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was told to get a commitment, and I was told by this man named Wendell J., that my commitment would be that I was to greet at the door of a meeting called Wilshire Normandy, which was then the biggest meeting in Los Angeles. This was long before the Pacific Group. This was on Sunday nights. And everybody went to Wilshire. So I was a hostile greeter. You know, you came to Wilshire, you were greeted whether you wanted to be or not, you know. And if you tried to go around the other way, we would intercept you at the pass. And Like I said, I came to AA with no life, which is a great way to come to AA, you know, and I used to get to the meeting an hour and a half early, and I would put my keys on the floor where I like to stand to greet by the door, and God help you. God help you if you stood there, because it was my place. And I started to find my place in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started to get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. Bobby never wanted to be my sponsor. He only sponsored two women that I know of, me and June G, because he didn't want to sleep with either one of us. And he spent, you know, 5 years trying not to sponsor me. And finally, you know, I did get a couple of other sponsors. And when I was 8 years sober, I got my current sponsor, Julie. And I'll tell you why she's my sponsor. She's sober 42 years. She's an honest and forthright member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She's active. She's smarter than me, and she's not afraid to tell me the truth. And that's why she's my sponsor. And she leads by example. She never really ever tells me what to do. She leads by her example. And Bobby told me very early on that if you want self-respect, what you do is you find people that you respect and you try to emulate them. And I've had amazing examples of people to emulate, among them Bobby. And I want to say something right here. I know that Bobby has become very controversial. If you have anything nasty to say about Bobby, please don't bring it to me. And if you have any compassion, I would say pray for him, because he needs help and all the help he can get. And I love him. And I will always love him, because he did what we're supposed to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. He took 5 minutes out of his life to change the course of mine. That's all it takes. 5 minutes. He took an interest in my case. I sponsor a woman named Cher who lives up in the Seattle area in Edmonds now. And I did something with her that I've never done before in my life or since. I went to speak at a women's recovery house years ago, because she has over 20 years now. And she had about 45 days. And I talked to her after the meeting, and I said, "Do you have a sponsor?" And she said, "No." And I said, "I'm going to be your sponsor. I've never done this with anybody else." But I sensed that if she didn't get a sponsor right that second, she was probably just going to fly off the planet. You know, and I've never done it since, and she's been sober ever since, you know, because we take 5 minutes out of our lives to somehow change the course of somebody else's, not because we're so powerful, but because God will direct us to what it is that he wants us to do. You know, Billy talked a lot about that, you know, the other night in his wonderful talk, you know, how, you know, we all have our jobs in Alcoholics Anonymous, and somehow I always seem to know what my job is going to be on a given day, you know? It's not always the same thing. Sometimes it's speaking, sometimes it's sponsoring, sometimes it's talking to a new person, sometimes it's setting up the chairs, putting out the literature, making the coffee, you know, whatever it is. You know, most of the time I'm willing to do my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I started getting involved in AA, and I have never not been involved in AA. I got a book. I read it. I got a 12 and 12. I read it. There were things in there that totally pissed me off. Here are two examples. The first one that really annoyed me was the line in step 10 that says, "It is a spiritual axiom that any time we are disturbed, no matter what the cause, the problem is with us." Now, I didn't like that, you know. I wanted the problem to be with anybody but me. And I thought that I came into AA ambivalent about God. I didn't come in ambivalent about God. I came in enraged at God. And I had an experience when I was 9 years sober of getting something that I really wanted and then having it taken away from me. And I won't go into the details because I don't really have the time. But I remember I was talking to somebody and I was shaking my fist and I was calling God a really bad two-part name beginning with mother. And I said, "How could he let this happen to me?" And the guy said, "Eileen, have you ever considered he allowed you to have it so you would know it was possible when the time was right?" And what I realized was that, you know, when you're not used to taking responsibility for yourself or your actions, you have to cast around to find somebody to blame. And I just went straight to the top. You know, why mess around with people? Just go straight to the top, you know. And that changed my attitude about God. And my attitude about God has been an ever-changing thing. It's been an ever-changing thing. I've looked into a lot of different things. I've looked into a lot of different ways for me to be able to explore my higher power. And one of the things that I love about Alcoholics Anonymous is that we don't all have to adopt one view of God. It is God as you understand God. It is God as you understand God. I read a little Buddha stuff, I read a little Jewish stuff, I read a little Hindu stuff, I go to yoga, I listen to tapes, I read the big book, I read other spiritual books. You know what? I'll take anything I can get at this point. Do you know what I mean? Because I need all the help I can get. When I was new, I used to resent the amount of assistance that I seemed to require to get through a day. You know what I'm saying? And now I'm kind of like, bring it on! And maybe it's because I'm old, you know, but about 1987, I love to travel, by the way. I am so happy to be here because there's nothing I love to do more than travel and get a lot of massages. And I had a massage today, and it was really good. I have to say it was really, really good, you know, and I love to travel. And I've taken a lot of interesting trips, but by far, the most interesting trip I think that I've ever taken is the one that I took to Israel in 1987. I was there for 6 weeks, so I got a chance to experience what it was like to be in Israel. Now, I love when people, I know that some of you come from much smaller geographical areas than, for instance, me and Hector and the gang from New Jersey, New York. You know, we are so incredibly spoiled. You know, I love when people come to me in Los Angeles and they say, I can't find a meeting I like. There are almost 3,000 meetings a week in the greater Los Angeles area, okay? We have a meeting directory that looks like a small novel. So I hand them the directory and I say, listen, do me a favor. Go to every single meeting in the book and then come back and tell me you can't find a meeting you like. I've done the simple mathematics. If they go to a meeting every day, it'll take them approximately 7.5 years to work through the book. The end result being they'll probably find a meeting you like, and you won't have to listen to their whining for a really long time. Anyway, when you go to Israel, you take what you can get. I went to a women's stag on Wednesday in Jerusalem. If we were lucky, we had 4 people. I went to visit some really bizarre loners on the West Bank. And on the weekends, I went to NA meetings in a bomb shelter in Tel Aviv, because NA is much stronger in Israel than AA. And the way that I got to these meetings is that right before I went to Israel, I had a crisis whose name I can't currently remember. So if you're having one of those, it'll pass, you know. And my sponsor was in Arizona doing a play or something and kind of inaccessible. So I called Bobby, whom I hadn't talked to in a really long time. And I told him I was going to Israel, and he said, well, of course, you have to call Nancy and Bob in Tel Aviv. And I said, who are they? And he said, there's some people I met in Hawaii in AA, but now they live in Israel. So I said, great. So I called this woman Nancy when I got to Israel, and she said, I know who you are. And I said, how do you know who I am? And she said, about a month ago, somebody in the States that I didn't know sent me a bunch of tapes, and one of them was yours. Anyway, while I was there, she saved my life. I wasn't getting along with my then employer, who's not my current employer. Israel was difficult, as I said, in many, many ways. And she was great. And I would go stay with her on the weekends in Tel Aviv, and I would go to these meetings. And one night I was giving a talk, and it was translated from English into Hebrew by a native German-speaking woman. I have no idea what they heard. But about 6 months later, after I got home, my telephone rang at about 6 o'clock on a Sunday morning, a time that I know all of you sincere people like to get calls. But I was a little taken aback. And it's this guy, and he says, my name is Avner. I'm from Israel. I'm in Spring Valley, New York. Do you know where there's an NA meeting? And if I had been at the top of my form, I would have said, oh, yeah, I got that directory in the bedside table. But I thought, no, you know, I don't even know where Spring Valley is, but I thought, I'll try and help this guy. So I say, I'm going to help you. Give me the number. And I call Central Office of Narcotics Anonymous in New York City, an experience I hope all of you have someday. Guy answers the phone. He says, hi, I'm Joey. I'm an addict. And I think, ah, shut up. Who isn't? You know, and, you know, because I'm a genetic New Yorker. And, you know, the guy got me fired up. And anyway, I didn't hear anything else until Nancy, the woman with Bob, divorced Bob, moved back to the U.S., moved to Santa Monica, California, where I was able to reciprocate. She remarried a guy named Larry. They go back to Israel, and there's Avner, of the phone call in a meeting, and he's clean, so maybe I helped him. Anyway, while I was there, I did what I could. I tortured a German woman named Christiana by making her write a fourth step and reading it to me. You know, I just did what I could, you know, to torture people so that I could stay, you know, fighting form. And anyway, while I was there, I went to Egypt. Why? Because you can. And my friend Bruce and I flew over to Egypt for two fun-filled days, you know, in Egypt. And I'll tell you, Egypt is a country where you feel like you're loaded even if you're not. It's like 190 degrees in the summer. We're riding around in an unair-conditioned Fiat. Being in Cairo in a car is like being on a funhouse ride from hell. There are no lanes. There's like five traffic signals. I think they're ornamental, you know, guarded by guys in immaculate uniforms with epaulets. And you share the streets with, you know, donkeys and camels and Bedouins and carts drawn by whatever. Anyway, by the end of the second day, I'm half dead. I'm half dead, I'm hopped, I'm tired. I'm reclining in the perfume palace in Giza. Now, I used to not be able to get off the floor. But now I'm in Giza, and I've been in the pyramids, and I've touched the Sphinx, and I've ridden a camel, and I'm dead on this couch. And I'm 12 and a half years sober, and a guy I've never seen before in my life walks up to me and he says, "I can get you some hashish." And I think, I'm in Egypt! Who would know? And then I thought, you would. And I thought, you know, you better get yourself back to that bomb shelter, even if you don't understand anything they're saying, because the disease never sleeps. It never sleeps. It doesn't matter how long I'm sober. I'm always going to have to go to meetings. I'm always going to have to work the steps. I'm always going to have to try and tell the truth about who I am. You know, Bobby used to say, if you're worried about having an image in AA, look around the room and see exactly who it is that you're trying to impress. And I've never forgotten that, you know. There is absolutely no point in my getting up here and telling you that I'm doing better than I am, you know, because there's no point. I desperately needed to identify with people before I got here, and I've desperately needed to identify with people since I've been here. You know, my life has been light. It hasn't been perfect. It hasn't been a straight trajectory to stardom, and progress isn't like that. You know, progress isn't like this. Progress, I've discovered, is like this. It's like this, and it's like this, and it's like this, because it's life. And I don't think that because we come through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, we are exempt in any way from life. When people die, it is appropriate to grieve. When we lose our jobs, it's sometimes appropriate to have fear. I have had a very tempestuous relationship in my life for the last 20 years. Currently, it's good. I don't know how it's going to be next week. You know, and I'm not here to prove that I can have the perfect AA relationship. I've had a very imperfect relationship with a very imperfect person, because I'm very imperfect. If you think there's going to be a time that you're going to get everything in a nice, neat little package and nothing is ever going to intervene again, think again. God has a way of throwing what I call his celestial monkey wrenches in the mix just to see if we're paying attention. And I got a whopper in 1996. It was 4th of July in the U.S., I was sitting on my couch drinking a large mug of coffee, trying to get my heart started. I was thinking, you know, I was staring out the window. I had 4 days off. I was thinking, oh, eventually I'll go to the store. I'll get the ingredients for the salad I promised to bring to the barbecue that afternoon. And my telephone rang, and it was a woman. And she said, "My name is Julie Jones, and I'm a private search investigator from Seattle, Washington. I've been asked to locate you." And I had no idea why she was calling. And she said, "Is your name Eileen Waterstone?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Does the date March 28th, 1969, mean anything to you?" And I burst into tears, because March 28th, 1969 was the day that my son was born, the one that I gave up for adoption. It was now 27 years later, and here he was. And I started to cry, and I said, "Is he in Seattle?" And she said, "Oh, no." She said, "We do this all by computer." She said, "He's in your area code." My son was living a mile and a half away from me, 27 years later. And she said, can I give him your number? And I said, no, God, no. I said, give me his, call him back, tell him I'll call him in a half an hour when I pick my stomach up off the floor, because I never thought this would happen. I was always open to it. I was never going to search because I felt it was an invasion of his privacy and that of the people who adopted him. But there it was. And I called my parents who weren't home, thank God. I called my sponsor who was home, thank God. I called a couple of friends. I called some friends who had adopted children. I got their blessing. I picked up the phone about a half hour later and I called. And I said, hi, my name is Eileen Waterstone and I understand you're looking for me. During the course of our first conversation, without knowing one thing about me, he told me that he had been in a drug rehabilitation facility. Imagine my surprise, you know. He was conceived on a one-night stand when I was drunk with Alfred Gimpy Ortiz. What was I expecting? Anyway, and I was 21 years sober at the time, and I thought, oh, what the hell? And I said, hey! What a remarkable coincidence. I said, I've been in AA for 21 years. And he wasn't sober then. And I could just hear it. It was like, oh, shit. Oh, God, she knows, you know. And I've actually never asked him why he did it. I think he either did it to impress me or to tell me the very worst thing about himself so that I would reject him. Neither of which happened, of course, because I've known thousands of people who've been in rehab. Anyway, I went to meet him 2 days later. He looks exactly like me, except that he's 6'3", 190 pounds, half Mexican, and a guy. But aside from that, we look exactly alike. And it's been a really rough, rocky road. He's been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for the last 8 years, mostly out. I don't think really ever in. He's addicted to opiates. He drinks a lot when he drinks. During this time, he managed to hook up with a girl, and they had a child. My grandson is now in foster care. My son, about a month ago, had a heart attack and cardiac bypass surgery. He's 35 years old. He has no history of high cholesterol or overweight. It's some weird genetic fluke. But what I discovered later is that in the 2 years prior to that, he was so loaded that he was able to ignore the chest pains that he'd been having all along. So he finally had this episode. He didn't get sober after that. I thought that would be the wake-up call he needed. My friend Harvey finally said to him, every guy I know in Alcoholics Anonymous has tried to help him. My friend Harvey finally said to him 2 weeks ago, he said, Aaron, I don't think you want to be sober. And right before I left for Spain, his girlfriend called me and said that he had tried to stab her with a knife and she's taken out a restraining order on him. So my great AA story didn't turn out the way that I wanted it to, but you know what? A lot of things don't turn out the way that I want them to, and I have to go ahead with my life anyway. I have to go ahead with my life anyway because life is for the living. And it says in Alcoholics Anonymous that if your prospect doesn't want it or the person that you're trying to help doesn't want it, you are obligated to move on to someone else. And I cannot waste time and energy on my son that could be better spent on somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous who wants it, or better spent on my aging parents who need my help now, or better spent on any one of a number of things that I could be doing that are much more productive than trying to help somebody to whom I am related biologically but who does not want this program. And that's the fact. And that's how it is. And that's alcoholism. Alcoholism is my Aunt Shirley who drank for 50 years and then committed suicide because she couldn't come up with a better solution for the end of her life. That's alcoholism. You know, we're not playing. This is not fun and games here. We are not a glum lot, and nobody has a better time than me. I'll tell you, I went with that gang of Americans and a couple of other Irish types who didn't understand the game. I stayed up all night in a bar with a bunch of Americans, watching a ball game, drinking coffee and soda, eating chips, staying up till 6:30 in the morning. It was the wildest thing I've done in a long time, you know? And it was fabulous and fun and so exciting. And even if the Yankees didn't win, my heart broke for you, Billy. It was great. It was great. Nobody has a better time than me. A couple of years ago, and I'll close with this. I've sung all my life. A friend of mine calls me the greatest undiscovered singer in Los Angeles. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what he calls me. I've sung all my life, and I was in a terrible rut a couple of years ago. I'd had a total hip replacement. My mom had had a knee replacement. One of the women who I consider my mentors died in the hospital in front of me. My grandson was born, and that brought up all the feelings about my son and holding this baby that was the same size, you know, when I had never held my own son. You know, the relationship went sour one more time. I was depressed about that. I was in a huge rut. And one day I prayed to God, and I said, God, just let me do something creative. Let me just do something creative just to get out of this rut, please. Let me write, let me sing, let me do something. And a friend of mine saw me in a meeting 2 weeks later, and he said, listen, Eileen. He said, I'm casting this production of Company, which is a Stephen Sondheim musical. And he said to me, I'm looking for somebody to play Joanne. And Joanne is, let's face it, the drunk acerbic bitch of the cast. And it was for no money. I actually lost money on the production. I had to spend so much on the false eyelashes. It takes place in 1970, you know, and just the gas back and forth, I lost money. But anyway, I got cast in this thing, and we were scheduled to run for 8 weeks, and we were a huge hit, and we ran for 16 weeks, and I was in it for 12 out of 16 weekends, and I showed up on time for rehearsals, and I learned my lines, and I learned my song, and I got along with the other members of the cast, and I did what I could to be a part of, and it was hard for me physically, because like I said, I've had this hip replacement, and I had to run all over the stage, and I had to do all of this stuff, and when we finally opened, we got reviewed by the Los Angeles Times and other papers around, and the Los Angeles Times, we were their critics' choice, and they said that my singing of my song, The Ladies Who Lunch, was sublime. In the Los Angeles Times, but of course my favorite review was the one in a local trade rag called Backstage West. It said, Eileen Waterstone is perfect as the drunk, acerbic Joanne. And it was like, how did I do that? How did I do that? I'm not drunk anymore. I try not to be acerbic anymore. We have a friend in L.A. named Riley. He says he had a tongue that could trim a hedge. And I try not to say terrible things to people under the guise of humor. I try to practice love and tolerance as my code. You know, I try to just allow people to be who they are today. You know, I try to allow people to be who they are. It's not important to me that people conform to my ideas about how it should be done. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is a wide open place. It has a huge umbrella. It will accommodate any drunk who wants it, and any belief system that they might have, any higher power or lack thereof. You know, all that you have to have, it says that our only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I've had the desire to stop drinking since March 3rd of 1975. I hope that I will always have that desire. And it also says in our books that when all else fails, help another alcoholic. It's been my great hope that I've done this for you tonight. And thank you so much for having me in Spain. Really appreciate it.